Hey Central Ohio, the nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Juan Castillo, and of course, this is the Electric Drum. Now, this morning, I have someone in the studio who has done a lot of things for our community. She recently retired from the New Haven Public School System, and I'm quite sure you're going to be inspired today. Her name is Wanda Gibbs, and she's here with us this morning. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, you just retired.
Yes, right? Yes.
So, you know... had a big bash and all of that.
Yes, that's wonderful.
That's fantastic. Well, let's get started. You know, you worked in the school system as a teacher and also a principal.
Principal, yes.
Right, right, right. New Haven school system. But let's get back to you. You from North Carolina?
Yes,
right?
Yes.
A little town called Albemarle.
Albemarle, North Carolina.
Tell us about growing up there.
Well, it was a very, very interesting time. Because it was during segregation. I attended a totally, totally black school from first grade to grade eight. I was a very, very close community, very, very loving community, very, very spiritual community. It was an excellent place to grow up. I believe we adopted the concept of it takes a village. All the way back then. Some of my teachers, one of my teachers is still alive and resides in Albemarle. And when I go back to visit, I just return. I always go back to see him. And we talk about how wonderful it was that I had an opportunity to leave. Because if I had remained there at that time, there were no opportunities for young people. So coming to Connecticut was an excellent move for me.
And you came here, you were 13 years old.
I was 13 years old.
Let's go back to North Carolina. Tell me about your family, you know, and growing up there during those 13 years besides school. You know, tell me about what was life like.
Well, it wasn't that great because I lived with an aunt. My mother came here to work, and she left my brother and I with an aunt. And... I had two aunts. My dad was there, but my dad was married and had another family.
Okay.
But my aunt and her family basically raised me. I had to leave because at the age of 13, I became pregnant.
Okay.
So it was not a favorable thing at that time.
Yes.
So it was discussed that in order to maintain the credibility of the family, that I come to New Haven with my birth mother.
Right.
Now, you would think that things would get better, but I came here 4th of July, 1965. I gave birth to my son on October 26th, and my mother died the next night.
Wow.
So in a transition from being a mother and motherless in a 24-hour span, needless to say, it was a difficult period.
And 13 years old?
13. I turned 14 on October 17th,
wow.
So I gave birth when I was 14.
Wow. Okay. So definitely overcoming the odds, that's for sure.
Yes.
And so tell me about, you know, trying to raise a son, right, and go to school in New Haven. In 1965, right?
It was 1965.
65.
But the fact that my mother died, I was mandated into foster care, and my son and I were separated.
Wow.
He was in one foster system, and I was in another foster system because of my age. And it's unfortunate, but we did not find each other. He came to find me at the age of, I believe, about 22 years, so...
Wow, what a story.
It is incredible.
Yes, it is. You know, and not unlike a lot of other stories in our community, you know. But again, one of overcoming the odds, because, you know, we're going to talk about all your accomplishments. But let's get back to that time, right? So now you're in foster care, and you got to go to school,
and you've
got to, you know, somehow find the fortitude, right? To after all of this, you know, these tough situations that happen in your life, you know, for you to now, okay, I got to buckle up and I got to take care of this. Tell me, how did you do that? And who was there for you? And how did that happen?
Well, I think, first of all, it was God.
Absolutely.
That knew, first and foremost, that he had a definite plan for me.
Yes.
I attended troop, and the teachers there were supportive. And the foster home situations were not the best. I mean, and I'm not anti-foster care. I believe that it's needed. But my foster care experiences were not great experiences.
Mm.
I've had some people, of course, at that time would take you in just for the money.
Mm-hmm.
I can recall many of times where other children had things that I did not have because I was a foster child. But it didn't kill my spirit.
Mm.
I went into Richard C. Lee High School, into an abusive foster home.
Wow.
And that didn't kill my spirit. Mm. I was very, very active in high school. Richard C. Lee High School was where I found the most supportive people. I think that was the groundwork for me being the leader that I am.
Mm.
Because my teachers were fantastic. They were hands-on. They were leaders. They cared about you beyond the classroom. And it was awesome. I was in the band. I was on the newspaper board. I was in a group called the Montu Players, where I traveled to different states in the United States. And it was just wonderful. That was the best academic experience.
So among all that chaos in your life, you found heaven at Richard C. Lee High School.
Yes, I did.
Right.
It was a very, very...
Who were some of the folks that you want to point out that kind of were there for you?
Well, it's funny that you should say that, because four of my teachers showed up at my retirement party.
Yeah.
There was
wow.
Mr. Bill Bobede,
mm.
Mr. John Courtmarch, Mr. Michael Eisenberg, and Mr. Thomas Ragazzino. And there was a teacher that Rhoda Spears was one of the greatest writers, Mr. Harry Reed. They, you know, they were all just awesome. The clerk ended up being a godmother to one of my children. So you can see there was an interest in the individual. The librarian at that time, who's unfortunately has gone on, was Mrs. Carly Anderson.
Mm.
What a great role model and a great lady. She taught us how to be a lady at that particular time. So it was a wonderful place.
That's great. This is Juan Castillo. This is the electric drum. I'm speaking with Wanda Gibbs. She has been teaching in the school system here in New Haven for many, many years. Grew up in North Carolina, you know, came here and became a part of the foster system, overcame that, you know, went to Regis C. Lee High School. We're talking about her time there and, you know, and how supportive that school was to her. And this is the stage of her life where we are right now. And so at Lee High School, when did you start thinking about, okay, you know, I can go to college, you know, I might be able to make something of myself. Tell me about those moments for you.
Well, that's funny, because I had a girlfriend that was going to college to study business.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I think that would probably suit me too. You know, she was into stenography and typing and all of that. I didn't have a clue. But there was an opportunity for minority students at Quinnipiac College at that time, in 1969, where there was a tuition waiver. And what it meant was that the professors would take one minority student above the maximum enrollment, and we could attend college free. So I applied. I was accepted to Quinnipiac under this fee waiver. But let me tell you, got there, all of the freedom. After the first semester, I was on academic probation, hanging out, partying.
So oh, now, wow. Okay.
I had to go before board.
Well, you're a party girl, too, huh? Okay.
Oh, yeah. All right. Yeah. I had to go before board and file an appeal. But wow. Then I realized that I was in the wrong major. So I decided to major in psychology. That was fine. I met my husband at that time, and we studied. And it was the two of us. And when we decided to get married in 1972, we got married. And one of us had to work, and the other one had to go to school. So being the head of the family, I said, I'll just let you go to school, get your degree, and I'll work two jobs. I worked at W.T. Grant's, both stores, downtown during the day, and they had one in Hamden. I would work there in the evening. Just to, you know, make sure that he got his education. And on his graduation day, he never made graduation because my daughter was born on that day. So,
okay.
But he did earn his degree.
Yes.
He had a degree in psychology. So that's basically, you know, a little foundation for you there.
Yeah. So now you lived, it's interesting, your life, because it's your life and times, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, you came from North Carolina where, you know, segregation was deep, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jim Crow was, and then, you know, you came here and there was a different kind of discrimination in the North, you
mm-hmm.
know, when you came, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There were turbulent times because it was during the Civil Rights Movement,
mm-hmm.
right? Tell me how all of that sort of shaped you.
Well, when I came in 65 at Troop, I didn't see a lot of that, but it was a culture shock for me because
mm-hmm.
here I was. I had a Southern accent,
mm-hmm.
so they used to definitely, and I still have a little bit because I'm always in North Carolina. Kids used to call me names. They used to nickname me Chitlins, Collard Greens.
Wow.
You know, oh, they used to play around with me.
Right.
But, and it was very, very strange to be in an integrated setting because I was always accustomed to classrooms with only black students.
And black teachers.
And black teachers. And determined black teachers. And teachers that would beat your behind really with straps.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, yes,
and,
yes.
That was definitely a big change for me.
Mm.
But I adjusted quite well. And I did very, very well. And as a matter of fact, some of the friends that I had in middle school, we're still friends today. So.
And then Quinnipiac was also a school at that time that, you know, there weren't many of us there either, right?
No, that was the time when I almost got arrested for being a part of a group sitting in the president's office.
So the life and times.
Yes, that was the life and time we're at Quinnipiac. But if people that are from here, they always knew that the Hamden police officers, you really just didn't mess with. I mean, that was just something. And as we're sitting there in the president's office.
Excuse me, why the sit-in?
Well, because there was an incident in the cafeteria where there was a disagreement between a white male and a female student. The someone threw some food on the white male, I don't know why, and he turned around and said, "Cool it, Aunt Jemima."
Mm.
So we're just, at that time, being militant, that was the time. This is 1969, 1970. You know, we were going to the president's office, and we followed the proper chain of command, and we felt that we hadn't been heard. So we had a minority advisor at the time that said, "Well, I think you all should do this," and that was to go and sit in the president's office. And he kept coming in, asking us to leave, and that he would meet with us, you know, at another time if we just, you know, just really, if we left his office.
Yes.
However, when we saw the Hamden policeman, we realized that it was really time to go because
mm-hmm.
none of us really wanted to get arrested.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And it's interesting because, you know, we're living in the times when, you know, folks, one of the concerns is that, you know, except for Black Lives Matter, you know, on the most part, you know, African Americans are not really doing those kinds of things today. You know what I mean? They're not asking for what we deserve, which is equality and justice. And, you know, and what do you think about, you know, today, you know, with our young people and with the election, is a referendum on, you know, where the country is going, right? Any thoughts about that?
Well, I spent an entire career basically trying to prepare students for such a time as this.
Mm.
I always warned them that education was important because remember the type of students that I historically had to deal with at Riverside and Transitional were the kids that everyone else, most people determined that these were kids that should just be written off. But I would have frank conversations with them about how my life was back then.
Mm.
And I shared it with them. And I told them that prejudice is not something that's going to go away because you cannot change the attitudes of people that are different from you. In terms of this political struggle that we're in right now, it's very familiar to me.
Mm.
The only thing that is not as prevalent is there's not a blatant use of the N-word.
Yes.
But it is the same subtle type of attitude that is existing and that existed in the 60s.
Yes, yes. You mentioned the N-word. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we used that word to refer to each other back then, right? Yeah. We were black and proud.
That's right.
Right? And if the word was used, it was used in a hush type situation. That, you know, even back then, some of our elders didn't like that it was being used.
Right.
Now you were dealing with these young people, you know, as just this year, this past year, right? Mm-hmm, just retired.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you heard the word being
very
used.
Very rarely.
Oh, they didn't say it in front of you.
Because I have a list of 14
yes.
written rules.
Okay.
And the use of the N-word is never appropriate, not even in an exchange between you and a peer. So they signed the contract.
Wow.
And they expected to be called on it every single time. But I didn't just tell them it was a rule.
Yes.
I indicated to them what it meant for me to hear it.
Mm.
You know, back in the 60s and the early 60s, you know, I was born in 1951.
So there wasn't no term of endearment.
No. I explained to them that when we would have to go to town, how some of the people would put their children in the window to sing the song, N-word, black is tar, you know, and those things, I don't find any humor in that.
Yes, or endearment for that matter.
I don't find anything that, I don't believe in it, I just don't. So.
Wow. Juan Castillo, I'm quite sure that, you know, you probably, what's going on over here, you know, we getting deep up in here, right? we're talking to Wanda Gibbs, you know, she's been with the school system for many years here in New Haven, and we're talking about her life and times, and, you know, right now, we kind of, like, veered off a little bit in terms of, like, you know, how her life went, you know, and we really didn't get to the part where she gets ready to graduate from Quinnipiac, and... what happens, Wanda?
I didn't graduate. I let my husband
graduate.
That's
right. That's right. You let him graduate. So mm-hmm. tell me what happened after that.
I applied for New Hampshire College.
Yes.
And they had an extension college here, and it was on Whitney Avenue.
That's right. I went there.
And one of the greatest professors in the world, God bless his soul, was Warren Kimbrell.
Yes, he was.
He was absolutely nothing but the truth.
Along with Clifton Graves.
And
you know, Arturo Lindsay.
Yes, Arturo, yes,
yes,
all of the above.
Yes.
They were great, great professors, and I received a degree because of them. You know, you go there, you went to Quinnipiac, you think you know it all. But Warren said to me, you know what? No, you're going to take this back because this is just not right, you know. And you would go, you know, have to keep going over it until you perfected it. But
and the thing about that school was the fact that, you know, they taught you from a different perspective,
mm-hmm.
you see, you know, and so when you wrote papers, you had to take a look at, you had to become a real critical thinker. So it wasn't about just being a parrot.
That's
Here's
right.
the information, give mm-hmm. it back to me, right?
No.
It was about, okay, what is your opinion mm-hmm. about these books and these things that we have given you? It had to have helped you as you moved on.
Well, it impacted me. I can't recall the title of the book or the author, but there was a book about an abusive woman, and her name was Mem.
Mm.
And Warren requested that we write a reflection because she was an abused woman, very, very abused, you know, by her husband. And the only thing that I could think of at that time was to write the paper in the form of a prayer.
Wow.
Asking God for deliverance from all of this pain.
Mm.
And I got an A+ on that paper.
Right.
But he thought it was very, very creative.
Yes.
And so they gave you the opportunity, you know, to express yourself in a non-traditional, you know, manner.
So you get your degree from New Hampshire. Where do you go from there?
Well, I'm still working at West Haven High School.
Okay.
And, of course, if you know the face of West Haven High School, I started in 1977. Things were not that much better.
Yes.
And I worked in an alternative program.
Okay.
I started out first as a $6 an hour toy demonstrator. I designed toys for preschool students. Mm. And that was in 1977. Well, I got a rash on my leg. I couldn't figure out what it was, and it turned out to be ringworm, and I never went back. I said no. So then I applied for a job at West Haven High School, and the first time I didn't get the job. And I was very, very adamant because it was a political appointment.
Mm.
So they wanted someone else. But I looked right in the face of the person that was interviewing and said, you know what? I may not get this job, but I'm the person for the job. So several weeks later, the person that they chose left, and they called me. And I stayed there from 79 until 86. I became the first woman to coach boys basketball with Reggie Hayes. And
yes.
I was just inducted to the West Haven Black Coalition Hall of Fame for that.
Yes.
And that was quite an experience working in an alternative ed program. I loved it. I loved the population. I loved the students. But I left because a woman and I, there was a Caucasian female and myself, and we were working in the program. She had gone to get her certification, and I hadn't received mine. I just had the degree, and we had to design a pamphlet. And I did all of the work for the pamphlet. Her last name was T, mine was G. So when the artist put the pamphlet together, she thought that her name should go first because she had the credentials. And they said, no, it's G. So she said, your name doesn't deserve to go first. So that really offended me because
yes.
we were friends prior to that.
Right.
But I borrowed money from a loan shark and went to Southern Connecticut State University.
Okay.
And I'm being honest. I'm keeping it real.
There you go. This is about the drummer's about keeping it real.
And I went into Southern that day to sign up, and I received a certification in 1 year that I needed to teach. And I was hired New Haven School System December 3rd, 1986. And it's just been great since then.
Tell me about the first day.
At Hillhouse High
yes.
School. First of all, they wanted to know who the lady was walking around with the briefcase because I had a nice new briefcase that they gave me at West Haven High. And they all said, who's this lady walking around with the briefcase, you know? But they soon found out. I had special education students, and they gave me all of the tough ones, but they had no idea that they were falling right into the plan, the master plan that God had for me.
Mm.
We don't live in a perfect educational world, you
yes.
know? Like now, there are more of that type than it is the other type.
That's right.
And they're the greatest children in the world. Always reminded people, these are the people that are going to take care of you. They're going to be the CNAs. They're going to be in the restaurants preparing your food. They're going to be the auto mechanics that are fixing your cars. They're going to give you all of the services that are directly related to you. And it really behooves you to be kind to them.
Mm.
And I have loved every minute of them, every single one of them, and every minute of this educational journey?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because, you know, special education, you know, there's always this stigma attached to it and so forth and so on, right? But the reality of it is that, you know, and you could explain that better than me, right? Isn't it, you know, an opportunity for a young person who might not learn the same way to then be taken off the regular curriculum where they treat everybody the same, so to speak? Is that the case? Is that how you approached it?
In most instances, I approached it this way. Everyone has a gift.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone can learn. You just have to find the way that they learn.
Mm.
My platform was basically on reading. College, the most difficult course for me was phonics. I'm a Southerner. I don't pronounce words the same as a Northern person.
Yes.
So I struggled with that. So I started to think with my own students, you know, how can they really, really, no one, they need to, there needs to be more than one way to teach a young person how to read. There's more than one way to teach a student how to do anything, basically. I have had wonderful success stories with special ed students.
I got to tell you, I mean, I came to this country when I was 10 years old. I came from Panama.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know a word of English.
Mm.
And so they put me in special education because
mm-hmm.
I couldn't read.
Mm-hmm.
And because I couldn't read and I couldn't understand, they thought that something else was wrong with me, right? And so I spent that year, that first year, learning how to read, right? Mm-hmm. And I was, as you see, you can hear, I don't have an accent, so to speak, because, you know, they say that, you know, when you get taught English and you come from a Spanish-speaking country, you're going to speak English with an accent, right?
Mm-hmm.
My teacher decided that was not going to happen, that she was going to teach me phonetically
mm-hmm.
how to speak English. And she was going to teach me the King's English.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't going to teach me any dialect of what was going on in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I sound like I'm from New York, you know, because that's different, right? You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Growing up in Brooklyn, New York, then, you know, I developed that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the English language became extremely important to me. And those, and of course, all those kids, all those people, you know, that was making fun, you know, now they hear me on the radio. So,
mm-hmm.
so here we go, right?
That's right.
But let me tell you what was very significant. My mother had to fight for me because they wanted to keep me in special education because they thought it was more than just the English.
Mm-hmm.
She said, no, he can go. He just needed to learn how to speak English. He can do math and science,
mm-hmm.
and now he can read. So therefore, he can read all the history books like everybody else. Like, why you want to keep him here,
sure.
right? Which would have held me back,
mm-hmm.
right? What do you think about that? You know, what do you think about the process of which that is happening even today and in throughout your career?
It happens all the time. The main problem is that educators do not meet students where they are. If you meet them where they are academically, they will advance. Even if it's on a first grade level, you have to start them on that level. We have an excellent computer program so that they can learn it in private. Before we had the program, if they had first and second grade reading books so that they wouldn't be humiliated, we would have someone drop them off at the house, so that they can practice, you know, what they needed. If you meet them where they are, they can make it. I think now people assume that if you're in ninth grade, you're on a ninth grade level. That's not true.
Mm.
There have been students, the average student that was transferred into my schools over the past, say, five to seven years was on the kindergarten to fourth grade level. So it's basically a problem in reading. And I think that there has to be a different approach, because if you can't process rules, if you can't read the rules, you can't understand the rules. So therefore, you're going to make other mistakes. So if you teach them how to read, they're very, very comfortable, because people don't run from things that are going well.
I think the other thing, by the way, everyone out there, my family out there, this is Juan Castillo, of course. You listen to Electric Drum. I'm speaking with Wanda Gibbs. She's been in the school system for many years. And we're talking about special education in this country. And I'm, you know, it's emotional for me because, you know, I went through the same thing. You know, getting back to that, right? It's interesting because, you know, part of going through that process, right, you know, when people are, like, making fun of you and all this other stuff, and you just mentioned, you know, like, reading in front of the class, you know, and all that. I went through all that, right? And I was a tall kid then, right? Mm-hmm. I was bigger than everybody else. So my first reaction was, I'm going to fight everybody. Mm-hmm. And so now I was labeled this troublemaker kid, mm-hmm. right? That now I got a discipline problem, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't have a discipline problem. What I had was, you know, a problem that people was messing with me. I didn't understand the language. Mm-hmm. I'm being picked on. And teachers didn't understand what's going on here, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting what you just said, because the times that I became a discipline problem was when I was asked to read in front of the class and they started messing with me. Afterwards, I was looking for all them kids that was laughing mm-hmm. to beat them up.
Absolutely.
And I became a discipline problem. So now my mother had to fight for me to get out of there because it was like, okay, he can't go mainstream because he's going to go over there and fight everybody. Mm-hmm. But I already learned how to read better than most of them kids that wasn't, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So she had to fight for that. Tell me about that.
Well, the rule, of course, in my school is when I interview, I meet with every student, every parent before they enter the school. I review every record. There are two people. We review the records to make sure that we don't make mistakes. I already know what the level is before you sit before me. But to establish a relationship, I say, can you read? Most of the time, it's a little bit. I assure them right there, you will never, ever be asked to read out loud. Mm. Reading out loud here is on a volunteer basis. And that has been the culture of the school. I cut through that because I know what it's like to be humiliated. Not because I wasn't smart, but I was different.
Yes.
So I would never want these students to have to feel, you know, someone picking at them because they can't read.
I'm going to jog your memory, but I'm just probably going to be easy. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about a couple of students that, you know, somehow, you know, with your involvement with them, you said to yourself, you know, Lord, mm-hmm. this is why, thank you, because this is why you put me here.
There's so many. There's so many.
Is there one in particular that you could think of? I mean, without, you know, confidence.
Oh, Lord, it's so, oh, no, I, but, oh, it's so many. It's, I think... one student that impacted my heart,
yes,
was a male student in the beginning of my career on Orchard Street when the school was transitional.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to reason with this young man, and this boy cursed me out so bad.
Wow.
Even to saying the taboo thing.
Yes.
You know, telling me to do this and do that. And I mean, to me, you know, God didn't give me the spirit of fear, but starting early in my career, I just thought that, you know, just let me just back off, use the channels, suspended the young man, didn't even expel him. Years later, I'm on the boulevard and it's late in the evening. That's when it was okay to work late without mm-hmm. having by yourself in the big building,
yes,
without having the fear of someone coming in. He came in and he brought his girlfriend.
Mm.
But he left her out first. But he came in and he said, do you remember me? And I said, yes. And he said, every day of my life, I want you to know that I regret what I said to you. And he said, my life has not been good, but I need you.
Mm.
I have my girlfriend here. Her mom is in a witness protection program. She's staying with me. She hasn't done well in another school. And I know that you're the person that can help her.
Wow.
And that was like huge for me.
Yes.
So the young lady came in and I still see her today. And she's still so grateful. But just for a young man to have made a mistake and respect you enough to come back, first of all, and apologize. That was a big moment. That was huge.
Great. They say that, and you coached, normally the team's attitude, their direction is a reflection of the coach. My coach used to always tell me, I play basketball, he used to always tell me, I was a point guard, so he said, everything that I'm about, you got to be about because you're the leader. You got the ball in your hands. You got to talk. You got to let them know. My philosophy's got to be your philosophy. But it was more than that. It was also about the environment. It was important for him to bring about this environment with the team where we didn't talk back to the refs like they do today.
No.
You picked up if opposing player fell on the ground, you picked him up too. Not as well as the other players. Supervision-wise, because you've had to supervise people, because mm-hmm. that's a whole different ballgame now. You ain't dealing with the kids, but you are dealing with some mature kids, mm-hmm. right? Talk about that.
Oh, supervise. Supervising, these were male students.
Yes.
I worked under Reggie Hayes, who was a great coach at West Haven.
Yes.
And I really, really didn't have a great knowledge about basketball.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a vision about academics.
Mm.
So he said, you can learn how to coach. So he would bring someone on to help me, Mr. Wilbert Patterson at the time, to come in to help me.
Yeah.
But I want you to get this academic piece right. You're in charge of the academics primarily, because he worked not at the school. He had another job that was 9 to 5. So I had to come up with academic lessons and all of these things to keep the kids busy from 2 o'clock until he came to practice. So the kids actually taught me about the game in that short time.
Yes.
And I can remember the greatest thing about developing a relationship with the fellas is I'm a visual person. So I was the JV coach, freshman coach, and sat on the bench with the JV coach, who was Reggie's brother, but the freshman coach. I would say, okay, line up the way that you should line up if you're on the first string. Then if this one goes down, you get behind him so I'll know who to put in.
Right.
Well, it happened that I was on the bench alone, and we were playing Wilbur Cross.
Mm.
And I beat Willie Elder, who is my ex-husband's first cousin. And he's never forgotten.
And he's been here.
He has never forgotten it. And I don't know how I did it. The guys, basically. But it was a wonderful time. It was really, really a wonderful time. It was a great learning experience.
And it's interesting because, even during that time, even today, it's a little bit better. It wasn't about academics. It was about just playing well.
Playing well, discipline. I had great, great young men on the team. Great Chief Waring's son, Mel.
Yes.
George Chambrelli. These were just the McMahon brothers, Paul and Michael. They were just great students, as well as being great athletes.
Right.
Very disciplined. You didn't hear them swear on the court. That good old-fashioned competitive spirit.
Right.
But there was one negative thing about being a coach at West Haven.
Mm-hmm.
The year that I left, the guys that I coached beat Hill House in the championship. So I was on the other side, so I just missed it. That was score was 71-70.
Absolutely.
Double overtime.
I know this is a political question, but, there's all of these new directions that education is taking. Okay, you got the charter schools,
mm-hmm.
you got the magnet schools. Back in my day, it was just junior high school and high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
In elementary school. But now you got the charter schools, you got the magnet schools. Of course, you got the prep schools. Also that are part of the program.
Mm-hmm.
You've got direction from Washington about what kids should be learning. Mm-hmm. You got schools being put on probation. Mm-hmm. You got teachers being judged on how well their kids test.
Mm-hmm.
You got all of that. right? You know, you got the African community as a whole and also the Hispanic community that is still poor.
Mm-hmm.
Parents are still working two jobs. It's hard to get to the PTA meeting. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's hard to get to the parent-teachers conferences.
Mm-hmm.
You got all of that going on, mm-hmm. right? You know, you got Hill House. You know, there were three principals. There were three mm-hmm. schools within one high school. Well, mm-hmm. you know, you left, but I know that you got some opinions, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first one I want to ask you about, magnet schools. It breaks my heart when I used to watch those parents in that lottery when their names weren't called.
Mm-hmm.
Breaks my heart. Like, to me, I'm just a simple guy. So I'm like, how come we can't teach all the, why can't all the schools be magnet schools, right? What's your thought about magnet schools?
Well, it's basically about money.
Okay.
It's basically about an additional funding source. This is just my opinion.
Okay.
I think that all schools should offer the same type of education as a school that's entitled a magnet school.
Yes.
In order, there was an allegation years ago about Riverside because the Office of Civil Rights said that we had too many black males and we were taking them away from resources.
Wow.
And we had to adapt the policy of being a magnet school to keep the Office of Civil Rights, give the students the opportunity to choose to come there.
Mm.
So in that case, that was a good thing.
Yes.
But in other instances, I agree with you that people live in neighborhoods and their students, their children have to go across town, you know, to another place. But me, I just do the best that I can.
Yes.
No, I do better than the best that I can every day.
Right.
Excuse me, regardless.
Yes, yes.
You know, of whether it was back to school or whether it was, right. you know, just Riverside.
So. Right, right. You know, we now are going into the privatization
mm-hmm.
Of our schools.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, we're bringing in companies are coming in and deciding that they want to build these schools, and these schools are separate from our public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And they're picking and choosing our best, right? You know, because you got to compete to get in there,
mm-hmm.
and they decide who's coming. And so, you know, we have these great, you know, results. So mm-hmm. it's like 100% of so-and-so prep is going to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, we got 30% is going to Ivy League schools,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, and it's great. I mean, I you can't say anything bad about it, but at the same token, you know, resources are being drained from our communities because of those schools.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right?
Right. I believe so. I believe that there's more money allocated into some of those schools. But what they don't tell you
yes.
is that the 30% that are going to Ivy League schools and et cetera, they don't return to give back here.
To our community.
Once they leave, they're gone.
Right.
So that's really how the story ends. A lot of people just don't return.
Yeah. Well, you deserve all the recognition in the world. You know, we recognize it here at WYBC. This community recognizes your work. We want to thank you for your service.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many kids are better off today because of you. And we are so happy that you came to speak to this community about your work. I'm happy you came to tell your story because your story is extremely inspirational. It's one of overcoming the odds. And so many of us, you know, we got a lot of unsung heroes in our community,
mm-hmm.
you know. And today we need, you know, more folks like you to be brought into the spotlight because, you know, our young people need to be motivated, you know. And sometimes, you know, they're being motivated by the wrong people,
mm-hmm.
and their heroes are football players and basketball players and you know, I mean, back in our time, our heroes was the pimps and all of them,
mm-hmm.
you know. But today it's the sports thing, you know, when most kids are not going to make it anyway, right? You know, so being able to have you here to talk about your career and how well you have done, but even more important, you know, what I hear from you is the joy and, you know, and just the feeling that you, that it wasn't about the money or any of that, that it was about the kids that you work with. Mm-hmm. And that's what you got out of it, you know, and I feel it, I hear it. And we want to thank you for that. You know, we want to thank you. And I asked you earlier to think about, you know, my last question. You know, what's the best advice you ever got and from who?
Well, before I say that, I have to say, you know, it's only fair that I say that my children are here for support.
Yes.
You know, it's the Dr. Davis and Tanya Scott and Walter Gibbs II.
Yes.
It's because of those good choices that they made that I was able to do so much for many. Mm. And I just want to just put it out there that I'm just so grateful for them and my daughter, Helen, who's in Durham.
Yes.
I received the greatest advice ever from my spiritual mentor. Her name was Mrs. Maysore. She was a part-time teacher. And I've been affiliated in a part of my church for nearly 40 years. But at that time, she said, it's not just enough that you are a member of the church. You have to model the behavior of Christ. You have to do Christ-like things if you're going to be a role model for these children. She said, every single day, you need to meet God. You need to have the building anointed. You need to anoint yourself. And she said, every single thing will just line up. And that has been just something that I've done ever since the day she's told me. And I have no regrets, but I thank God for her because that has just been a blessing to me. Just to know that I had to keep God in front of me in order to help so many young people.
Wanda Gibbs, you've been a pillar in our community for years. You know, please enjoy your retirement. Mm-hmm. I'm technically on retire. I retired 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and this is my retirement.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't know. They keep saying that, you know, maybe I'm just going to stay here forever. But, you know, at some point, we all must leave.
Yes.
And we thank you again.
Thank you. Thank all you right. for having me.
Absolutely. Juan Castillo with you. This is the Electric Drum. I'm quite sure you've been inspired. I have, you know, and please check us out next week right here on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City.
Hey, Central Ohio. The nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.